and welcome to Tabletop Game Talk, On Topic, a show where we talk about tabletop gaming topics of all kinds. I'm one of your hosts, Fletcher.
I'm Kitty.
And I'm Chris.
Today we're talking about what it takes to publish a game, what goes into design and development, what is the typical size of a print run, how much do publishers really make, and finally we'll answer the question, what should Kickstarter's role really be?
But first, as always, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, George Gia, Adam Harrison, the SGC, and Thomas Acciaretti. And a huge thank you to all our other patrons as well. We had a few more people adjust their pledge levels, so thank you. And we didn't get any new pledges, but we're still doing our giveaway, which we'll talk about at the end of the show, which will be in a few weeks or whenever we get, I think, 8 more patrons. All right. Let's see. Kitty and I did Adepticon this week, and that was fun. We're exhausted.
Yes, we are.
Fletcher, you didn't get to play all the Keyforge with us, but that's cool.
No, I went to California, Santa Barbara, and Carpinteria, and Austin, Texas.
That sounds almost as fun.
It was
a lot of places.
It was a lot warmer, that's for sure. And I missed the sun.
Yeah, it was not warm in Chicago.
It briefly snowed while we were at Adepticon.
Yeah. Thursday, it was
not that we could tell.
No, Thursday,
I drove around in a convertible.
I did not drive around in a convertible. Thursday was almost like sweatshirt weather, and then Friday and Saturday turned to nope, just kidding, it's not spring.
Mm-hmm.
So, shout out to Timothy Gross, Metadepticon. Played him in Keyforge on Thursday night, so that was fun. Hey, Timothy. I want Zachary to be Zachary, not Zach. So I'm trying to catch myself whenever I like shorten someone's name accidentally. And Kitty and I will do an after show. We did an after show conversation from last episode where we continued our discussion about Kickstarter pros and cons. So if you're a patron, you have access to that. And we were more civil off after the show, I think.
I don't know. I say things and then I forget that I said things and I just block them out immediately. And that's what we do feedback, because somebody quotes back what I said. I'm like, I'm not sure that's what I meant. Maybe it was in the moment. I don't know.
Well, speaking of our after show content, I did set up an RSS feed for Patreon. So if you are a patron there, you should have gotten a link to an RSS feed that you can set up to whatever podcast listener you listen to. It's not supported on all of them, but it's supported on many of them where you just like pop in the link and then you don't have to go to Patreon to listen to that content. And Kitty, Sydney and I will do one for the Adepticon Vault Tour, which was the Keyforge stuff that we did this weekend, so that we don't have to spend a lot of time here. And those people who are actually interested and patrons can listen to our wrap up of us just talking about game after game.
Because we could talk about it. We spent like the whole car ride there and back, like prepping and recapping all of the Keyforge.
And we were in different cars. So we're literally speakerphone back and forth.
Yep. It was ridiculous.
All right.
Sorry, I had to miss it.
We'll get you in the next one, which is in Origins. So I'll just have to get you to Origins and then you can participate.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. So this episode, we are talking about how the industry works. This is not meant to be a critique on whether or not the industry is good or bad. However, it is entirely possible that we go into that realm. But when we go into that realm, the intent is that we go in that realm with a little bit more knowledge of what's actually happening and knowledge as to why it's happening. I don't think
we're making judgments about the industry as a whole. We might criticize tactics a little bit, but I don't know if we're going to make any judgments about like all of board gaming.
We're going to try not to, at least.
Yeah.
I do want to shout out a couple podcasts that I find interesting to listen to that you can get deeper in on these conversations or these kind of ideas. The one that I think is the most approachable is Board Game Insider. It's another podcast on the Dice Tower Network. Stephen Bonacore and Ignacy Chevychek of Stronghold and Indie Cards and Games. However, he combines that together. That's for Steven. And then Ignacy does Portal Games. And they talk about different industry things and stuff that are happening there. So that's kind of it's a neat little behind the scenes peek. And then they answer a bunch of questions from listeners, which is also really cool. So I get a lot of information from them. The other one is this podcast was just released, probably, as you hear this, maybe last week. We'll just say last week. The most recent Covenant cast had a conversation about the three-tier system for publishing and retailers in board games. They had just came back from Gamma, which is a trade show for basically game publishers and retailers. And they had some really cool insights on how that system works from publisher to distributor to retailer to, you know, player, and why there are problems in the current system and why, and, you know, how that system can certainly be improved on. And we'll kind of touch on, I'll mention a few of those things as we go through, but we'll touch on that as we get deeper into this as well. All right. Are you ready for this?
Let's do it.
I think so.
Let's rumble. Okay. The game industry. Kitty and I, we were talking just before, and Kitty mentioned that it's sort of like publishing books. And I don't have a lot of insight on book publishing, but Kitty, you have a little bit more because you kind of hung with that community. I'm wondering if you can give us a background on how book publishing works. I think it's relatively similar. You're creating a physical product, trying to anticipate release.
It's not. So, no, it's not relatively simple. You write a book.
Not simple, similar.
Oh, similar. Yes. Okay. I think so. I think that the author and the designer have a lot in common. They are the creative force. They have the idea. They put the product together, either a book or the game. Then you have a lot of different choices of what you can do with it. You can self-publish. You can find an agent and get to a publishing house through an agent. You can approach publishing houses and pitch your book yourself, but it's much more difficult. You can send cold letters to different publishers, and you can try to self-promote and self-edit and have it all ready to go, or you can, you know, build up your brand enough that you get a lot of help into your book ahead of time so that it just publishes a lot faster.
What do you think about the recent trend of self-publishing, like going directly to ebook or directly to Amazon Kindle?
I think that it is very similar to what Kickstarter has done for gaming, but not quite, because it allows you to have control of your own process. It allows you to set your own price on your book, but it also does not give you a lot of the hype that a publisher will give you. You don't get a lot of the push to pre-orders and that kind of thing. And you also can't price your books as high as books coming from a publishing house will get priced. So it also flooded the market with a lot of people who are like, I'm going to put out anything I write. And there's lots of books that you can go buy for $2.99 that no one wants to read.
A lot of lower quality material that you can now get on your Kindle.
And you have to know what you're looking for more, and having a recognizable publisher on your things and having a brand, having author quotes on your cover, like all these things, you know, Nora Roberts loves this book, so you will too. You know, that kind of stuff has become a lot more important to getting your book read, whereas somebody who is an unknown before might have gotten a better chance because there wasn't as much to wade through.
Yeah. Well, and another thing I noticed is that if a particular author has a hit, then they tend to be able to actually, you know, push out more content. And once they have that one hit, it's like, oh, great, this is good. Isn't the author of, what's the Mars movie? Not First Martian.
The Martian.
No, just The Martian, not First Martian. The Martian.
Andy Weir is his name.
Yeah.
And
there's a blog at first, I think.
Yeah, it was self-published, right?
It was initially self-published, but a company then bought it. I think Penguin Random House bought and published it in mass market. A lot of authors, if you are a very successful author, you will get paid in advance to write another book. And then you can live off of that while you write another book so that you can make a living as an author. A lot of self-published authors have day jobs where you are working, writing, and you put it out there. Even people who work with agents who have publishers, a lot of them who are not these big hits, still work day jobs.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an author and you're not putting out like a book a year, or you're having not putting out like a crazy successful book every other year.
A crazy successful book a year, honestly.
Yep.
Or a really, really, really big hit. Like if you're a New York Times bestseller, yeah, you can live off of a book a year. But a lot of these smaller authors are putting out usually two books a year.
Yep.
Now at least.
Now the publisher is making money, because the publisher is not selling one book a year. They're selling dozens of books a year. So they're taking a cut of all of these different contents, but they're doing the risky stuff of upfront printing the book, trying to
print. So they just need one hit. They just need a few hits.
And not to lose money on the ones that aren't hits.
I mean, they could probably even lose money on them.
Yeah. They can afford to lose money on a few. I think the goal is to make up costs with almost all books. You can take a couple flops if you get a couple hits. And the more hits you get, the more risks you can take.
Yep. So the publishing industry and the game industry, I think, are very, very similar. There's a couple things that are different with the board game industry. The board game industry does not have the Kindle analog that the publishing industry does.
No.
With, you know, and except for maybe print and play, but print and play isn't, they're not really the same thing. Right.
Yeah.
It's a digital distribution of the game, but it's not something that people are actively thinking, oh, I'm going to just switch over and only do print and plays because I really like cutting up and making my own board game pieces.
And there are some purists in the book world who still only like to have physical copies of books. There's something tactile about it, but it's much more attached in board gaming that it is a tactile experience. It is a physical experience, and you can't print your, like, I mean, maybe 3D printing will get us there eventually, that it will become, you don't have to have a design, like, you don't have to have a big publisher. You can have, everyone all has their 3D printer in their house because it's 50 years from now, and that's just normal.
Yep. All right, so let's do, and I'm kind of looking forward to that day where I can just replicate my board game and then recycle it by dumping it back into the replicator so it can reuse all the pieces. That's what 3D printers need to do. We can melt down the plastic and like reuse it. Okay, so a few things. So that, and again, that is a lot of how the board game industry works. I will say that most of the information I'm going to share right now is from public information. The vast majority of game companies are privately held. And by being privately held, as in they're like a sole proprietorship or a partnership or something that, you know, they don't have to report their numbers. They're not reporting earnings or profits.
They're not a publicly traded company.
Yep. Now, CMON is a publicly traded company on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, or one of the Hong Kong Stock Exchanges. So they do reports. And so we can look at their quarterly reports and get numbers from them. We'll spew out a few of those numbers just for comparison's sake, but I don't want this to be a stock analyst type of thing. Steve Jackson Games, which has existed from the mid 80s, has voluntarily done reports on what they do. And I think he really does that to try and help other people in the industry and people outside the industry understand what it takes. Well, just how the internal numbers work. And Stonemaier Games has actually taken to do the same thing too. Jamie, he's like, you know, I like what Steve Jackson does, so I'm going to release those same numbers and you can kind of get that information. So a lot of this information we're getting from them. And one of the things that I think is interesting on all of these is just the kind of the structure that they're all running into and the problems they're running into, because these are three relatively, I don't want to say large, but known entities in the board game world. Mm-hmm. CMON's probably the largest by gross revenue, but Stonemaier and Steve Jackson Games aren't that far behind CMON, even though you'd expect them sort of to be. So just really high level at the moment. I want to take a look at CMON's 2018 quarterly numbers, because I think it's a little interesting to just kind of look at those. In 2018, the company reported a loss of $4.1 million for the first 9 months. So that was September, and first 9 months ending September 2018. So they had a really good 2017, but 2018 was not so good, and that it dropped quite a bit. They blamed that loss mainly on decreasing Kickstarter revenue and increased convention expenses. This is quoting from a the Tabletop Wire article on this. Revenue fell 32% from 17 million to 11.8 million in 2018. So, and they were, let us say, losses primarily due to decreased revenue from Kickstarters, including A Song of Ice and Fire tabletop miniature game and Arcadia Quest Riders. So both of these games were Kickstarters that didn't really do as well as they hoped they would do. And because of that, they lost, you know, basically $6 million from one year to another. So we all know that Simon basically uses Kickstarter to generate a huge amount of money and a huge amount of PR and sales. And when that fails for them, it's a huge hit on their company. Their profits declined from 47% to 39%. Also, they attributed that to fixed costs, cost of sales decreased as inventories declined and shipping and handling costs, which is another huge thing for companies, is this shipping and handling stuff. So if you look at this, these numbers are big. But when you're thinking of a company in general, 17 million for, even if you're looking at 17 million gross, that's not big at all. Like, that's a tiny, tiny company in the grand scheme of companies. So that's just kind of like your relative idea of like where Simon is.
Yeah. Yes, it is small for a company, but you know, board gaming is still a niche hobby. And as far as board game publishers go, I would say they are fairly large.
Yeah. Yeah, in the board game world, they are, for sure. Now, let's take a look at, Steve, Stonemaier Games, just in comparison. 2018, I think this is the full year. Stonemaier Games, I like his little summary here. And Jamie Stagmeier of Stonemaier Games has a blog, and a lot of times his blog is on Kickstarter, even though he doesn't use Kickstarter anymore, but there's a blog post on why. And he does post a lot of things about how the industry works and behind the scenes stuff. And if you're interested in this stuff, it is amazingly informative blog. His revenue in 2018 was $9.6 million. That's just under half of, or just over half of what Simon is. He is one full-time employee. He's the only full-time employee that works at the company. He released two games in 2018. He released two expansions and three accessories. Didn't do any Kickstarter campaigns, but he did seven pre-order campaigns, which he does on his own site. So that's an interesting number right there. Like, he doesn't deal in quantity. He deals in, I guess, what you'd call quality, because his games are sell very well and enough to keep him there. He does not share profits. Because he's one of the things, he's like, you know, this is our gross revenue. I'm not comfortable sharing profits. But he did share some interesting information that you can kind of then equate to profits a little bit later. But before we get to the profits thing, I want to get to his printing of games, of how many copies of games he made. So he says the number of SKUs they have, actually, the quantities below are lifetime units in circulation of each game. In all languages in the end of 2018. So Scythe was the biggest game that he's published. Global distribution since Scythe has existed is 254,000 copies, which is a crazy amount. The next most is Viticulture at 82,000, followed by Charterstone at 77,000, and My Little Scythe is at 47,000, and then Euphoria is at 35,000. These are huge numbers, mega numbers.
Yep.
And he says most of his distribution is done through basically distribution points. So he is selling to distributors that sell to stores that then sell his games. And even though I want to bring up the question on this, estimated it. Even though he does that, his direct market sales, the stuff that he sells directly from his website, he's able to get to like a 70% profit margin. The stuff he sells through distribution, it's like less than 40% profit margin. But because it's so much more copies, like that's where he makes most of his money from.
Yeah, that's kind of normal.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And now the thing is, he doesn't use Kickstarter. But one of the things that's interesting with Kickstarter, especially when you come to board game publishers, is it's like what we're talking about with the books and taking a book, like a self-publishing book, you can sell directly to the customer on Kickstarter. And you're cutting out the distributor and a bunch of other middlemen in there. You're still paying for shipping. You're still dealing with all the headaches of getting that game to the final person. But each, your margin on each game is a little higher. So that's why when you look at a Kickstarter game, you tend to get more for your money simply because if they don't plan to go to retail, they can kind of squeeze those margins a little bit.
Yeah, but Kickstarter also takes a cut too, don't they?
I think they take like a 10% of the cut of whatever you make on there. Yes.
Also, don't most of these games after Kickstarter go to retail?
I would say no. I don't.
I guess not most.
Yeah.
I think
some.
Some.
Yep. I feel like that's
often
everybody's
a
goal.
Successful.
Yep.
Yeah. A very successful Kickstarter campaign. I think the dream is then to be able to get it to retail.
Yep. And that's the idea, is if you do a Kickstarter campaign, you want to make enough money so you can print some extra copies, because that's going to allow you to sell it in retail.
And a lot of times when you're printing copies of a game, it is less expensive to print more copies.
Yes.
So if you can prove I already have 5,000 copies of this game sold, it doesn't cost that much more to run 6,000 than 5,000 at that point. You have really already sunk the cost in the printing.
Yep.
So that's how they often make it so we've prepaid for the 5,000. Now we can speculatively print the extra 1,000.
Yep. Now there's a little asterisk next to that. So, yeah. And all of that is true unless you can't sell the game, because now you have 1,000 copies sitting in your garage, or worse, you have 5,000 copies sitting in a warehouse someplace and you can't move those games. So now not only do you have the sunk cost of printing it, you're now storing it. And how long do you store it before you're like, okay, cut my losses. I'm going to, you know, just have to burn these things because I can't keep paying for warehouse space.
Right.
Yeah. But I think, and you know, companies, that's a risk that you take. That's part of doing the business, is you are saying, this is a game I believe in. This is a game I like and I want to print. And so you make it, and you know, that's the risk, is if other people don't feel the same way, you take a loss. And, you know, if you're doing smart business, you're picking good games, you should be able to sell them. And, you know, if you get a runaway hit, you'll be able to pay for some of your losses. And, you know, with Kickstarter, it really enables smaller companies to be able to take those risks.
Yeah. Well, I would say not smaller companies. I would say individuals. Individual aspiring... Yes. Game designers can take those risks because they don't have to have the capital necessary to fund a game. They don't know if it's going to sell or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's an interesting thing to look at versus a designer's self-published game, which is oftentimes Kickstarter, not all Kickstarters, but oftentimes that's where you're going to go.
Often,
if you're a designer. This is worth calling out right now. This is kind of an aside. If you are an aspiring designer and Kickstarter seems overwhelming, don't go to Kickstarter. Go to something like the Game Crafter, where you can design your game, you can publish it on the Game Crafter, you can, like, all the art, they make great games, boxes, everything, and you can sell it there, and it's a basically a print-on-demand board game shop. The price, your margins are going to be practically nil. It's not cheap to print on demand, but it's also a great place to do prototypes, too. So if you are wanting to do a Kickstarter, Get a nice prototype made up. But if you want to see how something works, go out there. However, on the Game Crafter, if you sell 200 copies of a game, you are considered incredibly successful on that website.
Yeah.
So, which makes sense, because an average mainstream published game, average print run of a first run game is 5,000 copies. That's what Wingspan printed first run, was 5,000 copies. And
yes.
Jamie's not new.
It is
new
a runaway success.
Yep. But Jamie's not new to the industry. He's, you know, he knows how it works. It's just distributors would not place an order for anything more than that for this particular game. And he couldn't fund anything more than that without knowing that there was going to be buyers there. So, and we'll talk a little bit about how that, you know, how you kind of anticipate and why it's difficult to anticipate with games. But his article on, you know, the public apology for Wingspan kind of gets into this and this problem in the industry that hasn't been solved yet of how do you anticipate how many games to print? Because you can run yourself out of business if you fail at this.
It's really tricky because, you know, I think right now Wingspan, it feels a little bit like this was a huge failure, but I don't think that's going to be the story in the long run.
No.
Because look at Terraforming Mars.
Yep.
They had this exact same problem.
Yep. They had no idea what the demand was going to be for this.
No idea. And it was out of, like, you couldn't find it for a long time. I feel like for even longer than Wingspan is going to.
Yep.
I think Wingspan is going to come back faster than Terraforming Mars did. And that's not what people talk about now with Terraforming Mars. I mean, sure, I just brought it up, but it's not the conversation anymore. The conversation is, what a great game. Everyone loves it. Sometimes there are people who don't. Sometimes their name is Chris. But it is always in the top 10 on BGG.
Yeah, and which is great. And so Terraforming Mars and Wingspan are actually kind of following that same curve, right? They both are very, you know, seasoned companies. Strongholds, mm-hmm. like, you know, they've been around for over a decade now. And Stronghold for that first decade, was just Stephen Bonacore. Like, he had some part-time help here and there, but basically he was the company and he had a full-time job for the first 10 years of the company. So there were no full-time employees unless you count him being full-time with Moonlighting and having an extra job. And both Wingspan and Terraforming Mars will bounce back. One of the things I thought was interesting, the Covenant podcast was talking about this and talking about this concept of catastrophic success, which both Terraforming Mars and Wingspan could have fallen into, and which is when you underprint something and there's so much demand that different game stores and people are pre-ordering it from a bunch of different places because the distributors aren't filling the orders. So if you put an order in for 10 copies of Wingspan, your store might have gotten two. So what stores will do is they'll put in 10 copies for like multiple different distributors, hoping that they'll get enough to fill their orders. And, you know, they can always cancel their order if, you know, they need to, especially the consumer side. The consumer side, they might pre-order it from three places online and their local game store. Well, as soon as they get one, they're going to cancel the rest. What happens is, say Wingspan prints 5,000 copies.
They print enough.
Everybody.
For all the orders.
Yeah. And all these pre-orders come in from all these different places, and the game store orders 10 from every distributor. So say there's five distributors. They ordered 50 copies. They only want 10. The demand comes back to Stonemaier Games saying, hey, we need 50 games. Okay, I'm going to print that. Oh, wait, no. We only really needed 10. So now they have 40 because they thought the demand was 50, but it was artificially inflated because of the shortage, which is another huge risk that they have to take into consideration because the people who are ordering the games can cancel at any time, and it takes months to reprint these games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a...
The lag there is just such a difficult problem to overcome, and you have to really know what you're doing. And it's a risk, and it can really backfire. But if you have a game like Terraforming Mars and Wingspan, you might have an oversupply for a while. But if you do have this successful long term, like people keep buying Terraforming Mars, I still see copies of it selling in game stores. You may have to pay some storage fees, but then you won't have to print as many in the future.
Yeah.
It is when you are now, oh, the demand was there, the supply wasn't, now we have an oversupply and we've filled the demand, then you end up losing money. That can really just destroy your game.
Yep. Well, and the problem really isn't when you find, you know, bump into a Terraforming Mars or a Wingspan. The problem is when you publish a game that you think is going to do well, you expect, you know, all the reviewers really like it, but it just doesn't resonate with your players. You know, they just like, eh, no, that's not really the thing. And you print 15,000 copies expecting that it's going to be a great hit, and only 3,000 copies sell. And you've lost a ton of money on this. So this goes back to this whole three-tier concept of distribution, which works really well for things that can be printed in a relatively small time frame. And the way that this has been described is your player will go to the game store. The game store will then go to the distributor. The distributor goes to the publisher. The publisher is going to then place an order based on what the distributors want for a certain number of games. And that's going to go to the manufacturer. The manufacturer is going to take a few months to print it, set it on a boat because they normally print it overseas, send it back. 6 months later, you have this game. 6 months out, nobody has any concept of what the demand for this game is going to be unless you're on Kickstarter. And then you know exactly what the demand is because people have already paid for it. So you can kind of hedge your bets and say, okay, we made a little bit of extra, so we'll print some extra games and hopefully we can sell them. But in general, standard publishing without going to Kickstarter, you don't know what the demand is. It is a guess, and you're just guessing, and you're hoping you're guessing as close as you can guess.
It's not a guess. You have information. It's not a pure guess. It is a hypothesis, I would say. It is a educated guess. You have some information. You are not just like, ooh, blind. You have your past runs. You have similar games. You have other things that you can guess based on. And that is why it is a calculated risk for a smart company to make.
All right. It is a educated guess. Yes.
Yes.
Which is why people...
It's not throwing darts blind at a board. It is looking at information. And that's why companies that have employees that are crunching the data that should be able to figure out, at least in some guesses, what the demand will be, don't necessarily need the Kickstarter pre-order model as much as somebody who, I've never made a game before. I'm just figuring this out. I am doing this out of my garage. This is part-time while I work another job full-time. Those people, I think that the Kickstarter model is there to get them the capital they need rather than just get the information that you could get elsewhere.
Yeah. I think you're still thinking that there's a company of people doing this. It's still usually just one person. Well, I think
in some cases there are.
I think she's just saying company as like shorthand. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like it's the person, the single person, typically.
I think that the solo game designer is perfect for Kickstarter. That's what the model is. I think that there are some places that have companies with employees that still use Kickstarter because it takes the risk out for them.
Yeah.
And I think that that is taking advantage of a model that is not built for them.
Yeah, I still disagree with that.
You don't want to agree with me.
I still very, very much disagree with that. I think that if you use – it goes along with the whole I'm creating a YouTube channel where I'm selling, you know, makeup unboxings. And suddenly I get successful, so therefore I can't use YouTube anymore because YouTube's for the small person. I should be going to Netflix. But
no, it's – if you – and honestly, there are people who are doing that. Christine McConnell.
Sure.
Has a Netflix show.
I get
it. She started on Reddit. She's moved on. She's making her mark elsewhere. She is putting her efforts in where they are appreciated. But what it really is to me is not that. It is Nora Roberts, an extremely successful and famous author, saying, I don't need a publisher anymore. I'm going to go onto Kindle and I'm going to self-publish all of my works from now on. And I'm going to keep charging retail prices, and I have all of this money from all of my super successful best-selling books, and I'm going to still have the same marketing campaigns that I have for all of my publishing house deals, and I can do this all on my own. And that now the standard for every self-published author is that you have to be Nora Roberts to self-publish a book, and that isn't fair.
Okay, but I don't disagree with the that isn't fair concept.
But... And I'm not saying like kick them off, they're not allowed here anymore. I just get annoyed with them.
Yeah. And it's a reasonable thing to get annoyed with. I don't know that business is fair. And if we say that, you know,
no,
publishing is a business, then I don't think fair comes into it. But yes, I agree with you on that sense that it is not fair that the little guy has to compete with the big guy in the same pool. Like,
yeah. And I think that it's, you know, it's the 8-year-old in the kiddie pool. It doesn't matter, you know, like the rule started out, this is for the toddlers, this is for the little guys. But nobody really said what age you get kicked out. So most people get out on their own because it's not fun anymore. But, you know, there's the one kid who's just going to hang around way too long, who's going to ruin it for everyone else.
Yeah. This analogy is really breaking down.
It really started out poorly and only went further off the rails.
All right, Fletcher, we've been talking back and forth. Do you have anything to say on this before I switch over to a little bit more talking basically about the designers specifically and how designers are work into this equation?
I mean, we talked about like the basic like manufacturing and going back and forth and how it's like a, you know, educated guess and all that. And in my head, it's just kind of like, this sounds like any other kind of small company that makes widgets, right? Yep. This could be like the clothing industry. You come out with something really cool. It takes time to, you know, to manufacture these clothing or like any kind of soft goods, really, be it bags or clothing or anything like that. You know, it takes time to go back and forth. Maybe there's a, maybe it's a fad item. Maybe it's not. It takes time to go back and forth. You have to guess and you can oversupply on anything. So to me, it just sounds like, yeah, this is kind of like business for widgets. Even Apple, like they have, they try to estimate how many phones they need to make so that they can, you know, meet the demand. And obviously they don't want to have a glut of iPhones sitting around, but they also don't want to make too few because people get frustrated. So this just sounds like the widget business.
Yeah. And the widget business is tricky. Now there's another thing that comes into play with the game widget, and that's the sales curve. Most of your money is made within 2 weeks after the game is released. And then that sales curve drops drastically. And then you have a tail, and you hear about, you know, the long tail, which is what you really want in a game. So you want to be able to sell copies for it as long as you can. But most gamers are, what's the new hotness? What's being talked about right now? That's what I want to go and want to get.
This is really similar to books.
Yeah, exactly. It's like
pre-orders are tech. Where it's at too. Yeah. Or tech, yep. Yes.
So when you're building, when you're making a board game, and that's another risk of printing too few at the beginning. I'm using Wingspan as an example, although it breaks this rule, or at least let's use Terraforming Mars as an example because I know it breaks this rule. But let's say that Terraforming Mars came out and it was a huge hit and everyone loved it. And so there was all this demand for it. So Steven goes back and he prints another 25,000 copies, prints 25,000 copies. And then 4 months later, because he rushed it, he got it back over here. And then suddenly it's still a good game, but it's no longer the hotness. It's no longer what people are talking about. And the demand that was there 4 months earlier is no longer there. This is easily happens on most games that get underprinted. It's like there's demand for it, but then something else comes in and replaces it very quickly. You have things like Terraforming Mars and likely Wingspan that buck that trend. And those are what they call in the industry evergreen games. These are games that they're constantly be creating, making new print runs of because the demand is much higher and a sustained height than your typical, you know, hotness of the week game. Kitty and I do the hotness every week, every Friday, and 70% of that list changes every week. And then there's Wingspan, Root, and Gloomhaven that sit up there.
We only look at the top 10, though. I wonder how much of the top 50 sticks around.
We could, I could do that over, we could start measuring that from week to week. I do glance through the rest of them, and I would say my gut tells me another 10 or so are always floating around in that list, where, and then the rest of them are basically kind of popping up and popping out. I know the Arkham Horror card game is one of them. Oh, there was a couple other in the top of my head. If I was looking at the list, I could tell you which ones have been there for quite some time. But the list does change pretty frequently. I would say, you know, 70% of that list is still probably true that it's getting cycled out on a regular basis. And that's just because, you know, you want the new game. Like, this is the same thing in video games. It's the same thing with books. It's the same thing with media. You know, nobody's talking, going out and buying the last Avengers movie. They're going to wait for the next Avengers movie that's out next month, right? You know, that's what people are looking at. And that's what people are talking about.
But you can also spike interest again. We're releasing a new Avengers movie. Everyone who's not caught up is going to go out and buy the last one so that they can catch up before the new release. And that's what I think the game industry has really figured out with expansions.
Yep.
If you are releasing an expansion, you're going to get another wave of interest in the initial game. And you can get another print of the base game to go with the expansion. It will renew interest. It can revitalize a game. But I think we have also become wary of the expansion just for the sake of putting out more material.
Yeah. Well, and there's actually an equation to that. So we talked about, you know, your first print run, you don't know how well it's going to be received. And that is, it is very, very tricky. You don't know how a game is going to be received. You just don't know. Who would have thought a game about birds was going to be so hot? Like, nobody could have guessed that. But when you have a run and you've sold 10,000 copies of a game, you know that if I put out an expansion, I am going to sell X percent of the original print run. And I'm going to get a bump of X of Y percent of the initial print and sell that many more base games. That is almost an equation that you can like spend money on. Like you can predict that. The more you do that though, the longer you keep putting out expansions, every expansion sells less than the one previous.
A little bit less.
Yep. And every expansion has less influence than on the initial base game than the one before it. You know, Terraforming Mars, again, is an exception. But when you look at something like a Thunderstone Quest by AEG, actually Thunderstone. This is a great example. Thunderstone came out. It was a great game. Everyone loved it. Expansion. Demand died down. They no longer could make expansions because they knew they couldn't sell enough to justify it. But there was still a lot of hype for the game. So what they did is they created a second edition, Thunderstone Advance. This drives some old players batty because it's like, wait a minute, I have this other game. Why do I have to buy this again? It's like, no, it's backwards compatible. It just doesn't look anything like the original. Okay, fine, whatever. But that is second version allows you to bring in new players because now there's a new entry point for them. And they know they're going to sell a certain percentage of the original and they're going to bring in new players and now they can do more expansions. Then that stops. Then they do Thunderstone Quest, which is no longer backwards compatible with the first two, but has a lot of the same cards, but it's a little bit different rule system. And now they're doing expansions for that. So that kind of model where it's like, we have a game system that people like. So if we just keep re-releasing it, more and more people can jump on and, you know, older people, some of them will come with us, some of them won't, but we can predict what we can print because we already know what the demand was before. And that makes it a lot safer for companies to do things like that.
The other thing that makes it a lot safer for companies is if you can get just a couple evergreen games, look at Stonemaier Games. They have Scythe. They have, I'm guessing, Wingspan now.
Viticulture.
They have Viticulture.
Yep.
They have those three games are going to enable them to take so many more risks with other games because they know that they will still be selling. Probably they have a number of copies every year that is just going to tail off. This is about how many we sell every year. We have this much of that money that we can put into new development that we can risk, that we can lose and still be able to make our company profitable.
Yep. And that's exactly what the companies need to do, especially if you're a publisher. All right. Designers.
Back to designers, because it's a completely different game for designers than it is for publishers.
So I'm reading an excerpt from an article on why it's so difficult to be a full-time designer. This is from DancingGiantGames.com. And they quote, on average, the first print run of a game will be about 5,000 copies or less. Since some designers usually get paid a fixed percentage per game sold, lower print runs mean less money in the designer's pocket. Now I'm going to insert here, the more games that are guaranteed, oftentimes the more that percentage will be as well. So if you're an unknown designer, you are making a far less percent than you would if you're a known designer and you're going to be part of being able to push that game. So what the next numbers take with a grain of salt, it really depends on your basically place in the industry. They continue. Game designers' royalties are usually somewhere around 5% of either the wholesale or retail value of the game, which is interesting because the wholesale value and the retail value are very, very, very different numbers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It just is another way of saying that this range can go from 1% to 10% of one of these values. It's all over the place. But for example, if your game retailed at $40, you make $2 per copy sold at 5,000 copies, print run, you would make $10,000. They put in there, not bad, but certainly not a livable wage for a year, which is, it would take you actually more time than that to make a game, but presumably you're not doing it full time in this situation. You may think that making only $2 per game is low, but considering all of the other costs that a publisher has to worry about, production, warehousing, shipping, distribution, marketing, other costs, and a cut for the publisher and retailer, if there is one, it's pretty good. However, going back to the $10,000 wage per year, your mileage may vary, that means you'd probably be looking at having 5 of your games published a year to make a decent wage. And that's a lot to ask from a designer new to the hobby. This is basically in response to why game designers really don't go full time.
Mm-hmm.
And some can, and some do, but even the ones that do are still pumping out games all the time. Richard Garfield, probably one of the best known designers out there because he designed Magic the Gathering. You would think that he'd be a billionaire on his own island someplace. I don't know what deal he made with Wizards of the Coast or if he makes any royalties on Magic at all, but he still puts out several games a year And that's just what he has to do, as far as I know, to stay, to make money for himself.
There's some of that that's, he has to do that to make money, but there's also some of it where this is what they love to do.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And some people, you know, he might have enough money to have his own island somewhere. I probably doubt it, but even if he did, he might just be the kind of person who's like, I have an idea. I want to bring it to life. This is what I do. And there are some people, this is just their passion. And it is really hard in anything to make your passion your job. Almost everything that is a creative endeavor, it is so much sunk cost on your part where you are putting in all of your thought, all of your time. Some people, they've been coming up with these ideas for years. It's just been something sitting in the back of their head, and you don't get paid for any of that time. That's never going to be like put back into the world for almost any designer. There are some exceptions, people who are going to have these like hit games, but you know, a lot of designers are doing it because they love to do it. And it's something they do on the side because it's fun.
Yeah, it's a passion thing for them, which is part of the problem. And because if you love something, if you care about something so much, you're willing to do it for far less than something that you don't care about. Like, you can pay me to design video games or, well, video games at the time, but you could pay me now to design board games, and I would take a far less, like, I would take less of a wage for doing that than what I currently do, which isn't a bad job, but I don't have the same passion I have for that job that I do for designing board games. And because of that, in order for me to continue to do that job, I need more money to do it. There's that balance. Well, the problem is when everyone in that industry is willing to just, they just want to work in the industry, and they'll work for anything to be in that industry, the industry undervalues itself and everything goes down, which then
gets like crazy people who put out a podcast every week, spending hours of their life for little to no,
to no money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a great example because we're all exhausted. We're doing this on Monday night, which is a different night than we normally do. We are going to be recording several more times this week because of schedules and things like that. But we have a passion for it. We want to make sure that we're out every Tuesday. You know, we're just as crazy as the rest of this industry.
Yeah. We're the problem.
We are the problem. Patreon. So remember, all this stuff. This is extra Patreon content. We love doing this. And I hate that we're putting anything behind a Patreon paywall, it's called.
But I made him.
But yeah, Kitty made me. And it's not a bad
idea. I'll take full blame for that.
Yeah. Think of it this way.
We'll never put our regular episodes behind a paywall. That's not a thing we're going to do. But for now.
Yeah. And it's really
all
not
nonsense under there.
The thing is, you can look at it two ways. Like, people who don't have Patreon can look at it as like, oh, well, you're hiding content from me because I'm not giving you money. So, you know, you're taking something away from me. But that's not how we see it. What we see is we have people who are willing to support us, and we really truly appreciate them. And we're trying to give those people something more and just a little bit of a bonus. So it's a fine line. And I think this takes us to our last subject that I want to talk about, which is the money grab.
Mm-hmm.
What to you is a money grab? Especially when we're looking at, like, within the board game industry.
If it's a business, that's the point, is to make money.
It's to grab it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, like, so sometimes there, I don't know what a money grab is defined as. To me, it's mostly when there's not something of value being sold. That to me feels like a money grab, is like, oh, they're just putting out this valueless thing trying to grab our money. But if you're putting out quality products and you're putting all this effort into design and publishing, putting all this thought into components and quality, that's not a money grab. That's a business.
Yeah.
And we are paying them for the value that we get, the joy that these games bring us, and how much effort goes into and how much thought goes in. It shows in the quality of a good game that you will play over and over again. There's value to it. So it's not a money grab to me. It's when it's something of lesser quality that they're trying to show up. That's the only thing that feels money grabby.
I've never really understood the concept of like a money grab, because it's like, if you think that it's not worth it to you, then you don't have to buy it.
Yeah. And so, you don't have to complain about it.
So right.
That, you know, judging other people who are buying it.
So I've never really understood that concept. It's like, well, if it's not worth it to you, then you don't have to buy it. So you didn't lose out on anything.
Yeah. I agree completely.
All right. The definition of money grab here is an undignified or unprincipled acquisition of a large sum of money with little effort. And I don't think that describes almost anything that happens in the board game industry, because it is a lot of effort. No matter what you are doing, it is all a lot of effort, if you ask me.
And it is not ever a lot of money. So I don't remember where I grabbed this quote from. I just put "the hound wrote." We understand the model. We just see it for what it is, a money grab. Oh, right, right. So this was...
Game of Thrones?
No. Stop it. But maybe.
I didn't know he was so well-versed.
So Mike Elliott, just as I read this, I realized where I pulled this from. So Mike Elliott, who is I believe he's a full-time designer. He has his name on a lot of games. He was a co-designer on Dice Masters. And Dice Masters was a collectible game with random packs. And each pack had two dice and two cards in it. And the packs were sold for $1 apiece. But they were randomized, you know, uncommon, commons, rares. And people were just up in arms about the distribution model of this system. And he wrote on BGG a thread that essentially said, look, we chose this model so we could make this game. If we didn't choose this model, we would not be able to make this game because it would not have been financially viable. We would have had to sell the boxes for a crazy amount of money. You could get full collections, but if the demand wasn't there, we would have lost all this. We have to invest in creating custom dice, all of this stuff. And then someone responded in came back in response to this. It's like, we understand the model. We just see it for what it is, a money grab. But please don't attempt to claim otherwise. You say that like it's a bad thing, though. I'm as liberal as they come, but I really can't understand the hatred that gamers and comic fans have for companies that want to make money. In most circles, people who figure out how to maximize profits are praised, not derided. Whatever. Mm-hmm. But in this industry, I see it all the time, where it's like, wait a minute, you're charging me $70 for this game? But that's how much it costs to make. They're not trying to price it to a point where we're going to make a ton of money on it. Like, there's a reason that it costs that much. And if you don't like it, you don't have to buy it. But it's not a money grab. It still is what Kitty said at the top and last week. It is still a business. Regardless of the model they take, it is a business. And if you want to keep making games and being in the hobby, you are in business and you have to make money. And the consumers have to realize that even though designers are willing to work for pennies an hour, literal pennies an hour, publishers can't, because they need capital to get those games out there. And if you think that publishers are charging too much for something, don't buy it, because supply and demand will adjust the price. But they're not trying to rip off the consumer. They're trying to make a product worth the consumer's money. And that is the business that they are in game publishing. And this is another fundamental problem in the game industry, where we just want everything to be cheap or free, or it's so easy to do this. It's just some art and some text, and, you know, you send it to China and you print it and you make some plastic molds and all of this. Why does it cost so much? Sorry, that was a rant.
Yeah, it's just a little piece of plastic.
Yeah.
It's plastic and cardboard. This is like $5.
And that's exactly what people... Yeah. So if you ever think anything's a money grab, I want to hear from you, because I understand that there are some people like, no, this is a money grab. Send me some examples. I want some examples. Just be prepared to defend that example. Let us know why you think this is actually a money grab, because I'm curious, and I'm curious to see what those are. Speaking of sending us feedback, though, I think this is the best we can do in an hour. Like I say, Board Game Insider is a great podcast. Ludology is a great podcast for game designers. The Covenant Cast, they've started doing a little bit more freeform stuff, and they do a number of topics on what it is to run a game store. And that's another good one to listen to. And I'm certain there's other ones out there as well. This was not meant to be in depth. It was just meant to be kind of an overview.
We barely scratch the surface.
Yes. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you have access to our show notes, and all of the links that we're doing for research is in the show notes. If you're not a Patreon subscriber, I would paste these into the show notes, the normal podcast show notes, but there's just too many of them. So if you're interested, though, just go to Stonemaier Games and follow his blog, or search for Steve Jackson Games or Simon Games quarterly reports or yearly reports, and you'll find the same links. Okay, let's go to listener mail. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first since I'm on top.
All right.
So I got two pieces of feedback. This is wedding feedback. I'm going to continue this train of wedding feedback. And if you got good wedding ideas, go ahead and send them in. So the first one is from Tim Gross. He says, 3 years ago, my best friend was married and had an amazing over-the-top wedding, over 100 guests, reception with gourmet food, wait staff, live band. It was awesome. It also cost upwards of $60,000.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Was his advice not to spend $60,000?
Yeah, essentially. He said, on the flip side, a year and a half ago, I got married. 30 guests. The ceremony was in our parents' backyard. The reception was at a restaurant, and the total price was less than $1,000 for everything. He says, my advice, go for option two.
Yeah.
Think about what you could do with your money. And I definitely agree, but sometimes you need a bigger wedding, especially, well, at least in my case, I am half Hispanic, and her family is all Italian, so we don't really have
have a small wedding.
We can't have a small wedding without literally just inviting our parents and pissing off a bunch of aunts and uncles. So I definitely overall agree with Tim, but sometimes it might not just be possible because of your background. And then the other one was from Tamazine Fritz. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this name correctly. And this person writes, I don't know if it's a he or a she. Any of you?
No. Nope.
Okay.
Let us know.
So, yeah, right back. Best advice before the wedding is to number your response cards. I guarantee you'll end up with a spreadsheet. Use those numbers and put them somewhere on a card so you have your guests send back. We got back at least six that were blank. Since I number them, we could easily figure out who they were. So I think this is actually really good advice to like number everything and have a spreadsheet so you know what the heck is going
on. Yeah, I actually labeled all of mine for my guests, and that took forever. So this is a much better system.
Yeah, because generically the RSVP cards are just like Mr. or just like an M and a line. And if they don't fill in that line, you're like, okay, two people are showing up. I guess I'll put that in the buy them food column.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things I heard, speaking of cost, is, and I don't remember where I heard this at, but somebody was selling tickets to their wedding. So when you RSVP'd, you basically RSVP'd with, you know, $250 because you're going to show up, and that's how much it costs to go to the wedding.
Yeah.
And although I totally understand the...
It's a totally good idea, but also a totally bad idea.
Exactly. Yeah. It makes perfect economic sense. Etiquette, though, it's like we've just, yeah.
Don't do that.
No.
I don't know if it's good advice or not, but I like it. I love that advice personally, but I don't know that I would follow through with it. All right, Kitty.
All right. I've got some feedback from Jesse that I will read despite the fact that his too long didn't read included Chris the winner. But his sum up little paragraph here, he says the final verdict on this. This is feedback from last week's episode on industry disruptors, which devolved into a Kickstarter fight. So he says, the final verdict, Kickstarter is a great platform to receive great products. It allows a means to let your voice be heard and participate in the surveys that may allow you to vote in the final decision of games/components. I'm okay with larger companies jumping onto Kickstarter with the understanding that it's not what Kickstarter was initially set out to do. I do not like the fact that it may pull backers away from smaller companies, however, which I think actually... he fell right in between me and Chris.
Yeah, well, I think most people were. We were pretty opposite sides there.
And I don't even think that we feel that way. I think it's just fun to take those positions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I really do feel that Kickstarter is helping the industry grow quite quickly. And it's tricky. Like, you know, I don't think CMON has actually done a good Kickstarter in the last year or two. So I'm not upset that they're losing money on Kickstarter. Their early Kickstarters were just way better. And I think that it's showing that, you know, backers, just because it's CMON, yes, they're going to get a certain amount there, but they're not anywhere close to what they used to be able to get because they haven't put out a game that's been drawing, you know, gamers in and saying, I really want this. So,
yeah, I think it shows that the Kickstarter model of, but you get so much, doesn't work if you don't have something substantial there to hold up all the bits.
Yep. My email is from Terry Ash, and there's multiple points here. I'm just going to cover a couple of them. The first one, we were talking about, you know, fraudulent games and Amazon. This is, again, is on our industry disruptors. He, I think it's a he, maybe a she, another ambiguous. Sorry, Terry. T-E-R-R-Y. Is that the...
You can write in with your pronouns.
Yes. Well, and that, yes. So Terry says, I hate that there are fraudulent duplicates of games on the market. This is really wrong. Not to show my support for them, but some of them are hard to tell the difference, which is why it is a challenge for places like Amazon sometimes to tell the difference. I bought a game on Amazon once and never knew it was fake until I went to a convention and saw someone else's copy, then did my homework and found out it was. And then he mentions on Amazon, a miniature market, he's like, people seem to rip off rip on online stores like Amazon Miniature Market and Cool Stuff for ripping into the local game store's profits. I don't go to the local game stores very often. If these local stores want to compete, they should compete with what they have to offer and the online stores can't, a place to game and services. So change the name from game store to gaming pub or gaming house, focus on services and charge for it. I like this. I do think most successful game stores now are building communities as opposed to just being a outlet to buy games at. Game stores certainly still have a place, though. Like that whole spontaneous walk in and see something you've never seen before because I don't spend all day on Board Game Geek is an important service that basically local stores serve the industry and the gamers. But you got to have something more. You have to build communities there. Let's see.
I can't tell you how many people came up to me at Adepticon, and when they found out how close I lived to my local game store, were like, what? How come I haven't seen you there playing Keyforge? I got yelled at over and over and over again.
And that's great because people know these game stores, right?
Yeah.
So, and we met some friends playing at Adepticon, new friends. We didn't know them before, that they're friends now. Like, oh yeah, I play every Tuesday at this game store. And I'm like, great. Now I know I can go to this game store and, you know, hang out with these people that I would love to hang out with. Let's see. Board game distributors, Terry continues, make money either way. But because of the online sales, they get way more money in units sold. This is what keeps the industry going. Units sold, period. If they can sell, the publisher will make more money on it. So that's basically where Amazon is making. It's good for the publisher. It's good for the designer. It's good for everyone because they can sell more money. It's not good for the local game store. And that's the tricky part of this whole thing. Finally, the one I want to read is, should companies like CMON use Kickstarter? Quote, hell yes, exclamation point. For all the reasons that Chris said, and one not so obvious one. Because they are on Kickstarter, people will go to Kickstarter to back their games. But while they are there, they will look at other games that couldn't afford the same level of marketing. A very recent example is Critical Role. They didn't need to use Kickstarter to get their funding, but for slightly different reasons. They could have simply created a Patreon page and asked money like you guys do. Maybe we should go to Kickstarter. We're not going to. We might eventually. I'm not saying we never will, but we don't have the numbers right now. They said they would have gotten their funding, but they probably got more funding with Kickstarter hype. But they also brought people to Kickstarter. And during that time, Immersive Battle Mats for Tabletop Games was doing a Kickstarter. They wouldn't have made anywhere near the funding otherwise. Just check out the comments for the Battle Map book. They were talking about Critical Role. Funny, I backed the Battle Map, but not Critical Role. So I do think that there's something to this, right? That it's that big shoe store bringing you into the neighborhood and all the little shoe stores that are around it getting splash business. Like this, you see this in physical retail all the time. You know, these competing businesses all in the same clump. Even if one is a mega store, those other ones are still getting splash business from that. So maybe there is an upside to these large companies.
Yeah. And I don't know if we addressed that maybe last week, but I know we've talked about it before that, you know, it's a real tricky, you know, situation here where it does draw so much attention, but it also draws up the level of production that you have to have where, you know, I don't know how many times I've said it, but it's definitely more than once. You have to kickstart your Kickstarter. You have to have so much put into it before you can even get onto Kickstarter that it just feels like, I don't know what it is exactly, but it just feels unfair to the little guys that can't produce these high quality videos, don't already have their game books, you know, translated into six different languages, that you don't have to spend all of the money to get your footprint out there the way that now sometimes it feels like you have to have such a high production value to be on Kickstarter, when the whole point of Kickstarter was to not have to go through all these hoops.
Yep. Yeah. And we had some other feedback, people pointing out that, you know, because of the hype of Kickstarter and the big things, you pull out scammers and things like that. And there was a recent Kickstarter that was caught to be a scam, but Kickstarter killed it before. One of the things with all these big companies is it bringing more people in is the platform starting to police itself fairly well. People still get scammed. Sometimes these things don't get pulled down in time, but there's a lot of due diligence done on these larger Kickstarters being, you know, just by the community saying, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't jive right. Something's up here. And it's becoming a safer place, I think, because of all the extra eyes on things. But yeah. All right.
But it is also becoming harder to get onto.
Yep. So speaking of publicizing your Kickstarters, Patreon. So us. if you want to be a patron, come on over. TabletopGameTalk.com/Patreon is a quick link to it. Or you can go to Patreon and search for Tabletop Game Talk. We just have three levels. Well, two levels, really. 2 o'clock or 2 o'clock. The $2 level, which is just, it unlocks all of the Patreon stuff. The $5 level unlocks all the Patreon stuff and gets you into our credits. And then we also have one spot available for a friend of the show. And if you want to advertise on our thing, we will do stuff that we like. So email me before, but there is a ad level now for 4 shows. You'll get a blurb someplace in here and we'll talk about your stuff. So if you're going to do a Kickstarter, why not bring everyone that we listen to or everyone that listens to us into your Kickstarter with you. And as soon as we hit 65, I think it's 65, total backers, we will be doing a drawing for Wanderer, The Curse of Barnacle Bay, or 4 weeks from now, I think. I should actually put a date on there, but it was episode 140. So this is 37, 38, 39, 40. So 3 weeks from now, episode 140, we'll do the drawing one way or another. But if you want to win The Wanderer, The Curse of Barnacle Bay, you can join our Kickstarter. Also, everybody who gives us input or feedback or emails us, you are automatically entered as well. You don't have to do anything. If you're a patron, you don't have to do anything at all. You are automatically part of it. But if you are interacting with the show, you are entered. If I know your email address or username, you are entered. There's nothing else you need to know. Just that. Okay, I think that's all I have. Kitty and then Sydney and I will do another little bonus episode on Adepticon. And that is good. You can follow us on Facebook @/Tabletop Game Talk Podcast, Twitter, Tabletop Game TLK, Kitty's Lawful Good Mom, Fletch is Net Fletch, and I am Game Master Chris.
Tabletop Game Talk is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. Thanks for listening, and remember, we love your feedback. So email us with comments or questions about today's topic at feedback@tabletopgametalk.com.
Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons. George, Adam Harrison, The SGC, Thomas Acciaretti, Jason Strong, Terrence Milter, Stephen Seitz, Michael Ohl, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, C. Marie, Rudy Liu, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Wang, Wang, okay, Stephen Phil. You know, one of these days, I'm just going to pick a bunch of names I actually can say. Stephen Phillips, Caleb O'Brien.
Jennifer Engelbrecht, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, David Redke, Nick Quickstra, David Sellers, Jason Rodney, Michael Yanikowski, Miles Clark, Cindy Lum, Phil Schwartzel, Ann Reynolds, Eric Huffman, Adrian Dong, Christopher Vincent, Nate, Baz Flintham,
Sean Pear, Peck, Eric Solander, Mike Smith, Trevor Davis, Wesley Traylor, Tim Vernig, Chris Lowe, Joe Hoover, Timothy Gross, Glenn Cotter, Jesse Wolkowiak, Barry Peterson, Ben Gary, Emil Jewel Jacobson, Marina Stevens, Brady Meltzer, Gregory Huber, and Don Gilstrap.
Until next week, keep playing games and having fun. role-playing games are what we're going to talk about next week. So, yeah. Fletcher, you can actually participate in this conversation.
Huzzah!